Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let's get down to business. Mental self-defense or fitness. The rest of the show.
You got to go for what you know.
To make everybody see. In order to fight the powers that be. Fight the power.
You can fight the power or you can be the power. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we'll revisit two segments that deal with African-American history, past and present. In a moment, we'll hear the story of True Soul Records, a tiny, black-owned independent record label based in Little Rock, Arkansas in the 60s and 70s. But we'll start in the present with a new book by the writer and television host Touré. It takes on racial and cultural identity in an era when the current president is black and the dominant musical style is hip-hop. The book, whose provocative title is Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now, is part autobiography, part cultural analysis, and draws on interviews with more than 100 thinkers and artists like Chuck D from this group, Public Enemy. When Touré joined us this past November, I started out by asking him to distinguish between a term used in the title of his book, post-blackness, and the media buzzword, post-racial.
Well, actually, I have an essay on the New York Times site right now trying to attack and destroy this meaningless and baseless con man of a word, post-racial. Post-black and post-racial are two entirely different terms. Post-racial is something that I think refers to we're in a world where race no longer matters, so stop complaining about race. But I'm not fully certain exactly what post-racial means. It's not really fully nailed down, mm-hmm. really. It sort of reminds me of the line from the new Jay-Z and Kanye song. It's provocative, but nobody knows what it means, but it's provocative. post-black talks about the complexity of what it means to be black today. The infinity of identity choices. Skip Gates talks about if there's 40 million black people, there's 40 million ways to be black. Post-black deals with the idea of being rooted in but not constrained by blackness. You know, it comes from the art world, artists who wanted to be black, deal with black traditions and black people, but then have the right and the ability to not deal with those things when they wanted to, or deal with influences that are untraditional, quote mm-hmm. unquote.
So artists who wanted to be seen not necessarily as black, capital B, artist, capital A, but just as artists.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, when you remove the burden of representation, as an artist, you get wings, you know, like Red Bull. You know, you get a liberation that you can do so many different things rather than having to represent the race all the time.
But the book is called Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? Who is afraid of post-blackness?
Well, you know, I think that when we're talking about stretching the potential of identity to infinity, some people get a little nervous with that. You know, I'm expanding the tent to say, hey, every way that you want to perform or embody or do blackness is legitimate and okay. And some people are sort of traditional bellwethers of this is what it means to be black. Get a little nervous when I'm saying, hey, you know, you don't get to decide. Each individual gets to decide what blackness means for them.
Although, you know, some people who have kind of taken you to task for this book have pointed out that a community, any community, it is a community because it is defined somehow. And there, at some point, there is a boundary beyond which you cannot go and still be considered a part of that community.
I mean, you know, that's an interesting idea. And when I confront those sort of ideas, it's like, okay, you know, well, what would be something that would be transgression to the community, especially where I'm talking about identity? I'm not even talking about things where you're actually committing treason against mm-hmm. the community, but just, you know, what would be an identity choice that would mean, well, you're no longer black?
Well, you actually raise a really interesting example of that in a very funny chapter on the Dave Chappelle show, where, you know, the guy, the blind black guy who thinks he's white, thinks he's a white supremacist, thinks he hates black people, doesn't realize. I mean, is that guy black? Is that post-black? I mean,
the Clayton Bigsby episode is a really amazing sort of smashing of what it means to be black today. The whole Chappelle's show is amazing, sort of an amazing representation of post-blackness and the complexity of blackness. I mean, I would move that unfortunate embodiments of blackness are still blackness. Uncle Tom, who's snitching on the other slaves when they try to run away, is still a black response to white supremacy and oppression. Mm-hmm. It's an unfortunate response. It's not helpful to the community, but that's still a way that, and we see these same sort of differences in the Jewish community, in other communities. People from other races have told me, hey, I'm dealing with the same stuff, and I'm Asian, and I'm this, and I'm that. So, I mean, these issues of what it means to be in the community and not in the community, everybody is dealing with this.
So every community has, like, the cranky old lady who, if you hit the ball into her backyard, you're never getting the ball back, you know, that sort of thing. All right, we're speaking with Toure. His book is called Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. We'll cycle back to the Dave Chappelle show in a moment, but hip-hop is something you have written about throughout the course of your career.
Yeah.
And in the book, hip-hop is kind of emblematic of this evolution of racial and cultural identity. We heard Chuck D and Public Enemy coming in.
Sure.
If we were to, like, skip ahead now to somebody, say, like Kid Cudi, what's the difference there in, you know, what it meant to be black when Public Enemy was fighting the power in the late 80s and Kid Cudi now?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying with post-blackness is that we're in an era. It's not that certain people are post-black and certain people are not. We're in an era where the identity potential is infinite. Anybody can perform blackness any way they want to. So Public Enemy is classic representation of blackness, you know, beautiful brothers, brilliant, fighting the power, you know, sort of the sons of the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. right? Kid Cudi is embodying blackness in an entirely different way. You know, all the things that we know about him, you know, where he comes from and what he's all about, it just seems entirely different. I mean, I see...
Where is he from? What is he?
Well, he's from Cleveland. You know, he's much more of a hipster, much more of a stoner. He's sort of proud of that, so I'm not outing him with anything
like
that.
Right.
I mean, you know, we see a classic difference in the Kanye-Jay-Z pairing, you know, which is in New York City this week. Mm-hmm. Jay-Z is sort of classicist in terms of black identity. You know, I'm from the hood. I'm rich, but I'm still keeping it to the G code and the way he carries himself, those sorts of things. You know, obviously, you know, proud black wife. Kanye is comporting himself differently. You know, he's always with the white women in the videos. He seems very European influenced. He's very high fashion influenced, quick to wear women's clothes, quick to let you know how sad he is or emotional he is about it. I mean, he did a whole album of sadness. Hip hop does not do sadness at all, right? Maybe one song here and there, but like, when do you have multiple songs about a woman hurt me and I'm going to pour out my emotions for a whole album's worth?
A great old Saturday Night Live sketch had the hip hop ballad, "Yo, get back in the car."
Exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. And Kanye's expanding the emotional palette of hip hop.
Well, this is Kid Cudi featuring Vampire Weekend. So
well,
this
he's rhyming,
is Kid Cudi.
He's rhyming over a Vampire Weekend song in this, and this is sort of the cross-cultural clashes that we get in this generation.
Don't know, yo. I guess this was the life I chose. Wanna get up in my mind. Wanna know about me and Amanda Bynes. Wanna know really, really, really who I'm dating. Is she civilian or super duper famous? Is she African American, Caucasian, or Asian? Or maybe Spanish? Yeah. It don't matter. I love them all as long as she don't need stupid amounts of makeup to make up the self-esteem. Selfish dreams to reflect the blessing. I am that blessing on a cloud. Successful raps on my scream out loud. Putting it down for all I meant. I'm talking fans, I won't quit. I'm putting it down for all I meant. I'm talking fans, I won't quit.
Cutter is back.
And you hear there, he's not spitting in a way to say, hey, look how tough or great or awesome I am. It's more how smooth and cool I am. The tone sort of flits between like rapping and then kind of syncopated singing, and his voice is kind of softness. He's allowing much more of the full emotional complexity of what it is to be a human being out into the track.
And that's before you even get to the words. Is she Caucasian? Is she Asian? I mean, you know.
He shouts out Amanda Bynes to be like, who's talking about Amanda? I mean, like, look, when hip-hop first starts, right, it's very New York, street, heteronormative, you know, thuggish most of the time. If you're not an actual thug, then you're talking about what the thugs are doing. You're street knowledgeable. Now we are multi-class. We are national. There is a large, if not talked about, underground gay scene. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and we see people like...
In hip-hop, just to be clear here.
Yeah. I mean, we see people like Andre 3000 and Questlove and Kanye and Common and Cuddy, who are representing entirely different forms of and visions of what it means to be black, as opposed to what Jay-Z and Nas and The Game and Snoop are representing, and everything can sort of co-mingle together. You have groups that with The Roots, which combines black thought, classic blackness, and Questlove, more avant-garde. Same mm-hmm. thing with Outkast. Same thing with The Throne, Kanye and Jay-Z.
We're speaking with Touré, the cultural critic and author. His book is called Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. There is a whole chapter that deals with the Dave Chappelle Show.
Yes.
A late lamented Comedy Central classic. Because that is, for you, maybe an early kind of very visible example of what you're writing
about. Well, the most visible, the clearest example of the concept of post-blackness ever aired on TV. I mean, you're talking about Grey's Anatomy gives you post-racial, right? Those people, black...
Wait, you said there is no such thing as post-racial.
Well, there is. It's certainly not in the real world. Occasionally in art, we come across it. So in Grey's Anatomy, and I think in The Matrix, we have... black and brown and white people interacting, and it doesn't matter what they are. We could switch their races around, and they
and it would
be
have no exactly, material impact.
Exactly,
yeah.
They'd be exactly the same. Chappelle's show is very rooted in the races that people are, but it deals with the complexity of what it means to be black and white and Asian in today's world, and even the sort of shape shifting that happens within that world. He thinks that his Clayton Bigsby character thinks that he's white. You know, which mirrors some things that we think happening with a Clarence Thomas, with a Condoleezza Rice. Then in that scene and that sketch, they encounter some white people, call them the N-word. So then they become, quote unquote, black for a moment. And they're thrilled by the transformation. And all these sort of shape-shiftings are happening. And then just the different modes of performing blackness, like in the Wayne Brady episode. There's lots of complexity of blackness in Chappelle's show.
And the racial draft, you know, the draft pick.
Yeah.
where the different racial groups are kind of drafting the newcomers. And Tiger Woods, who is, of course, biracial, is chosen by the black delegation in this racial draft skit from Dave Chappelle.
No surprises there, fellas. The richest and most dominant athlete in the world. His father, black. His mother, Thai. Well, it doesn't matter anymore because now he is officially black. Dave, the Asians have got to be upset.
There's no question about that, Robert, but he ought to think about it. He's been discriminated against in his time. He's had death threats, and he dates a white woman. Oh. Sounds like a black guy to me. Tiger's taking the stage now, and if you ask me...
Wow.
Looking blacker already.
I'd like to say it's a tremendous opportunity for me. Finally be part of a race, have a home. Been so confused if I'm Caucasian, so many things. So long, fried rice. Hello, fried chicken.
Oh, man. Touré, there's just so much wrong with that in such a great way.
it's so beautiful. And he's dealing with the complexity of race now, even that some of us can't choose. You know, I mean, we're mm-hmm. a little of this, we're a little of that. And just being forced to choose one is just comedically ridiculous. I mean, and even, of course, he goes into, like, Wu-Tang being chosen by the Asians. So there, it's just a cultural affinity that allows them to slide over to another race. This is the sort of culture mixing that is typical in modern times.
You mentioned how the term post-blackness comes from the art world. Yeah. At several points in the book, you interview Kehinde Wiley.
Kehinde. Yeah.
Great. Artist.
Yeah. I
stumbled upon a show of his at the Brooklyn Museum many years ago and immediately had him on soundcheck because what he does with the combination of hip-hop and kind of old Renaissance, Baroque era European painting is... I mean, it is what you're talking about,
Absolutely.
Like right there up on the canvas.
Absolutely.
And for folks who haven't seen Wiley's art... I mean, maybe you can describe it.
Well, I mean, you know, imagine, you know, those old 14th century paintings where a man would show how rich he was by having somebody paint him in, you know, in sort of photorealist sort of way. So we see his sword and his shield and his family crest. And okay, so now take that and take in cut in a black kid from Harlem wearing the latest gear and the pager when that was hot, and the, you know, the cell phone and the headphones. And so he looks like a photograph straight out of 125th Street right now, but he's sort of photoshopped or painted into this image that is clearly some 14th century. And I mean, you know, it's such beautiful, amazing work. And it's sort of culture jamming in a way, in that Kehinde grows up in California going to galleries because his mom wanted him to paint, to not be part of the streets. And he's going to these amazing galleries, and he went to Moscow as a kid to see art. But he's like, well, where are the black people? Everybody on the walls is white. And it's like he's like speaking back to the tradition of, I'm going to paint black people into that old tradition, because otherwise they won't be there.
Now, this gets us into the whole question of authenticity, of keeping it real. Mm. And one of your chapters is keeping it real is a prison.
Mm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I mean, this idea of keeping it real is about normative blackness. And when you're not keeping it real, you know, you can't really expand your wings and be whoever you want to be when you got to keep it real, right? That's like the police sitting there watching over your shoulder, like, are you doing the right thing? I mean, to go back to Chappelle, he's got these great sketches when keeping it real goes wrong. And he's got, you know, Vernon Franklin in the office, his white mentor boss, disrespects him, you know, sort of classic microaggression, talking to him in black slang, which he would not talk to anybody else in. It's totally insulting. What does he do? Well, he keeps it real and gets street on the man and beats his butt. Well, then the next thing you know, that he's working at a gas station because keeping it real has gone wrong. Could he not have found a more complicated and nuanced way to respond? Because I've had moments like that, where people are coming at me saying things that are racist. You can't do such and such story because you're black, right? And not even in so many words, but I know what they're saying and they know what they're saying. And if I jump up and say, hey, that's racist, I'm going to overturn your table now. Well, that's fantastic, but you'll never work at that magazine or that television station again. But if you find a more subtle way of coming around the flank and attacking them from the back, then you can get in and you can succeed and you can get to do the story and prove that you are greater than their expectations.
You can jump out of that airplane at 14,000 feet and get the parachute wrapped around your arm, which is the opening scene of the book.
That's right.
Which is not a scene you will soon forget. But on a much more kind of pernicious level, there's the story of the editor who asks you, can you write about Run DMC? Yeah, but can you write about Eric Clapton?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, that's what you, as a black guy, write about Eric Clapton?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I was just talking about.
Yeah.
That I couldn't say to him, that's racist, you know, even though that's what I wanted to say, because then that would end the conversation, right? And I would not be able to work for him again. And he has all the power in that situation. So even though I'd be right and he's committing the injustice, you know, that's not a move that I can play in this particular chess game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had to chill instead of keeping it real and then find another way around. And I eventually got to counter that perception and prove that I could do those sort of things. And, of course, some of the audience will be thinking, well, Eric Clapton in particular is a horrible example because he comes from the blues. He idolizes Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
It would be very valuable to have a black writer talk to him.
A guy who knew about Robert Johnson before it was hip to know about Robert Johnson, yeah. We're speaking with Touré. His book is called Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. Another artist who you interview for the book and who is sort of emblematic of this is Santigold.
Santigold, yeah.
Who was Santogold for
right.
her first album.
That's
now
right.
it's Santi White. Santigold
right.
is the name she uses. And she really kind of is omnivorous musically, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. I mean, like, what an amazing sort of way that she sort of takes from punk and dub and reggae and electronica and all these different things and makes her own sound. I mean, like, can you categorize it? Like, is it electronica? No. Is it dub? No. Is it pop? No. Is it R&B? No. Is it hip-hop? No, it's...
It's all of the above, and ultimately, I guess, something other
than
all
genre.
Of the above. This is Santa Gold from her first album in L.E.S. Artistes. L.E.S. Artistes, a kind of wry look at the pomp and the posers of the Lower East Side art scene.
Look, if people haven't heard this album, you have to pick up Santo Gold. That's the name of the album. Mm-hmm. She told me there's a new album coming out this year. I don't think it's going to come out this year. I think it's going to come out next year. I'm very excited. This is one of the most interesting musical thinkers we have right now.
And, you know, how many people heard this song without knowing the race of the person singing it?
Oh, sure.
I mean, it was certainly the case for me.
Sure.
And, you know, so is that post-black or is that post-racial on our part, the listeners who are absorbing this music without any sense of the color of the person making it?
I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think that I would deal with what Santi is doing as the creator in that she's creating music that is not sort of rooted in, you know, anything, or it's rooted in many things, but not constrained by blackness or the need to be in R&B or this and that. I mean, that experience we've all had before when we first heard Amy Winehouse before I saw the videos. I thought, well, you know, obviously this is a sister, you know, and there's been other people who've had a certain kind of voice, and we think, well, obviously they're black, obviously they're white, and then they're, oh, they're not.
Yeah. Early days of hip-hop, Double D and Steinsky just assumed that they were, you know, kids from the South Bronx. They were like older white guys, you know, worked on Madison Avenue. We're speaking with Torre. His book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, is about cultural identity, racial identity, how it's evolving, being redefined. You mentioned Henry Louis Gates Jr. before, Skip Gates, saying if there are 40 million black Americans, there are 40 million ways to be black. The late Heavy D was yet another kind of image of a black man, especially at the height of his fame, which would have been, what, almost 20 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, but he had a nice long run, you know, hits in the 80s, hits, bigger hits in the 90s. Really gentle, sweet, loving guy, talked a lot about love, talked a lot about
being a big guy.
But sweetness, you know, and spiritual generosity, you know, now that we've found love, what are we going to do with it? You know, just a really gentle, beautiful guy, wanted to spread positivity, wanted to be, you know, in the party and having fun and, you know, just, I mean, what a wonderful person.
Music from the late Heavy D and the track Now That We've Found Love. The rapper and actor had died just the day before we talked with Torre here on Soundcheck. Torre's recent book is called Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. And what it meant to run a black-owned record label in the 1960s in Little Rock, Arkansas. We'll hear about a funky little independent label named True Soul Records. This is Soundcheck.